Anne Tapp is the Executive Director of the Safe House Progressive Alliance for Nonviolence. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
There's an awful, awful news story that is on the front pages of newspapers around the world that's happened in our local community. A woman murdered her two children dead. She was pregnant as well. Granted, it's a legal case, so we want to be careful of the language we use. But when something like this happens, when you have a domestic situation, is there a knock-on effect that you're hearing from people at this time who are concerned about domestic violence in an overall sense?
Yes, and it's a horrific, horrific case. And oftentimes what happens after cases like that in the kind of headlines is that people will reach out to us. Sometimes they're people who are experiencing violence, but oftentimes it's friends and family who are worried about someone in their own lives and seeing just the horrific tragedy of the Watts family on the news makes them reflect, you know, could this happen to someone I'm worried about?
And very often then we see the interviews with neighbors or friends who initially seemed to express a lot of shock and say, I had no idea that there was anything going on.
Right.
Very often, if you follow these stories, and I'm thinking of some very high profile cases in recent years, after a while it emerges that, well, there were some quite obvious signs that something was amiss and that there was violence happening in the household.
Right. And again, we don't know the details in this case, but frequently there will be kind of indications or signs, whether it's the survivor, the children becoming more isolated. Violence escalates often when there's a separation or a pending separation. Actually, and this is a little counterintuitive, but there's a higher risk for violence when a woman is pregnant. So there are risk factors that that we know about. And as you're saying, too, I think sometimes friends or neighbors, family, we start to look back, like, what did I miss? Or was there something that I should have seen that I just didn't pay attention to? And those are important questions for us to ask ourselves.
We'll talk more about that for people who are listening right now, who maybe have a sense that something's amiss with a friend or a colleague or a neighbor or somebody in their family. We'll talk about resources that are in fact available. But just this awful case that's happened now, I know that you've reached out to the community to offer support as well. So it's not that your organization just provides support for survivors and people dealing in the immediate issue of domestic violence. You're also looking at the kind of, I suppose, the ripple effect in the community.
Yes. And, you know, in tragically, there have been a number of domestic violence-related homicides in our community over the past few years. And what we have found is that often it's the community that's left behind. Neighbors don't have an opportunity to talk about the trauma they're experiencing, and particularly people in that circle who may also be experiencing violence in their own relationships. The kind of high-profile murder cases can create an enormous amount of fear and sometimes even silence for people who are worried about either their own relationships or someone in their lives. So we found that reaching out to communities and just offering the opportunity for people to come together, talk about the person that has been murdered or has died, get information about the signs and signals around domestic violence, and deal with the trauma, their own trauma, deal with sort of the residual impact of the reality of domestic violence in our lives.
So when you say reach out to the community and offer services, I mean, how does that manifest itself?
At this point, we're working with some of the organizations that are a little closer to Frederick to see what resources they have available. But what we're hoping to do is plan just an open community forum, again, just an invitation for people to come together. And when we've done this previously, there's some people, they just want to come together and be quiet, just to sort of be in a space where they're honoring the person that they've lost, and other folks that really need a chance to talk and process. And again, I think we get so focused on, you know, the drama around these horrific tragedies that we lose sight of the people who are impacted and really would benefit from just the opportunity to learn more about the issue of domestic violence and to share their own fears and concerns.
And I suppose this really does lead to the point that there's a huge ripple effect when you have violence like this. And obviously, this is the very extreme end of this. There are hidden situations of violence happening all around us all the time. But the ripple effect, when you have somebody who witnesses violence, I know there have been studies done on the impact of children who are in homes with domestic violence. If they're not physically assaulted themselves, the pure act of witnessing it and living in that environment has massive implications and impacts. But it then does, what about the neighbour or the friend or the colleague who knows this is going on, who's more of an indirect witness, who sees the aftermath? Are there any studies done on how that impacts people further removed from the person who's dealing with it?
It's a great question, and I'm not sure if there are specific studies, but again, if we just kind of extrapolate from our own experiences, if there's a tragedy in our neighborhood, a house fire, someone dies unexpectedly of natural causes, a car accident, those are out of the ordinary experiences that can oftentimes trigger memories of other traumatic or violent experiences in our lives. So the reality of exposure to trauma and violence is significant. And there are lots of studies that look at war zones and people that are impacted just by violence in and around their lives. And again, I think that we don't do a good job as a community, the large community in the U.S., of addressing the as you're talking about, sort of the ripple effects of violence, that we focus on the survivor and the offender, and rightfully so, but we ignore the opportunity to really use, again, these unfortunate, tragic, but high-profile media focus on the issue of domestic violence. We lose the opportunity to learn more as a community about what we can do and how all of us are impacted by violence.
And in terms of, you know, the media reporting and the responsibility in this, I mean, this is going to be on 24/7, I mean, certainly for the next few weeks, and it has been. And in one way, you know, that bears witness to the absolute horrific nature of this, but also then there are so many other cases that will never be reported, and violence that happens every day. But when you have such a strong media cycle, and it's on all social media, it's on all the newspapers and of course television channels and everywhere, does that trigger then people who are dealing with it or have dealt with it? I mean, do you see an influx of calls maybe after something like this, that people are either prompted to seek help or maybe are being re-traumatized from a previous experience?
Yeah, and that oftentimes happens. But also I want to say the flip side can happen too. I think when the media focuses on these just the tragic consequences of domestic violence, it can give the message that, you know, my experience of violence in my relationship really isn't that bad, or I'm not, you know, it's not going to be that. So, it can minimize or diminish a survivor's own experience. And I think it's an opportunity for us to sort of to reinforce the importance of people to reach out, whether they're experiencing violence or they're worried about someone in their lives who's experiencing physical or emotional violence, a controlling relationship. And if you're just concerned about a friend, a family member, or neighbor, to reach out. And, you know, our hotline is an information line too. So people can call and just say, here's what's happening. Do you have suggestions or are there resources that I can provide?
And that number, which we will have on our website, kgnu.org, is 303-444-2424, 303-444-2424. What happens if somebody calls that number?
They will reach a crisis line counselor who can provide information about resources that are available. If someone's calling and they're in need of counseling or advocacy or even shelter services, then the counselor would talk through what the caller's needs are. And if those are services that we have available, then we get them connected to the services. But I also want to say, I think it's very important that family and friends feel comfortable reaching out. And there is just this reluctance that we have, I think, culturally to interfere. We don't want to overstep bounds. We want to be respectful. And that can create reluctance to say something or ask questions of someone that we're concerned about. If that's the case, if you have someone in your life that you're worried about, know, go ahead and call our information and crisis line. You can lay out what the situation is, get some ideas of ways that you can respond. Just get some real information. We all do better when we have real information and can, again, sort of break through the silence and secrecy that oftentimes comes with domestic violence.
We're speaking with Anne Tapp, who is the Executive Director of the Safe House Progressive Alliance for Nonviolence, or SPAN. And she's joining us in the KGNU studios this morning. And obviously this tragic, tragic murder case that we've seen in our own community here, kind of prompting, I suppose, in many ways, a discussion around domestic violence. Obviously, there's so much unknown and so much that will come out in the course of this case now. But at the same time, domestic violence is happening all around us, and rarely to this extreme end. People are living on all aspects of that spectrum. So, and first of all, what geographic area do you serve?
Our emergency shelter is in the city of Boulder. It's confidentially located. We also have office hours, counseling and outreach hours in Boulder, in Lafayette, in Broomfield. Anyone in need of services can contact us. So we don't have any... We don't exclude people if they're from other communities. Oftentimes, we want to make sure that services are geographically accessible. So we want to connect people with services in their communities.
But I know you're broadly connected to all the other services as well. So if somebody calls that number, you can maybe refer them somewhere else.
Absolutely. If they live in another community where there's closer, more convenient services, we'd want to connect them there.
Well, that number again, it's 303-444-2424. And it is called a crisis hotline. But as you said, you don't want people to be put off thinking, well, my situation
isn't
that
dire. Yeah,
don't wait
for crisis.
You can call in, just get information.
Call anytime, yes.
Okay, we'll have that information online. Well, the shelter that you talk about, obviously a secure private location in the city of Boulder. Is it 10 years old now?
Well, you know, we first started providing emergency shelter almost 40 years ago. And it was in an old, literally 100-year-old home that had been renovated, 12 beds. In 2008, we loved that space, but we'd outgrown it. And there were a number of reasons why we needed to move. So we moved into a larger facility, a beautiful facility, 27 beds. And in the past 10 years, we've sheltered nearly 4,000 adults and kids. It's almost 100,000 shelter nights, and still with the original carpet. So we're using this 10th anniversary as an opportunity to do just a beautification and renovation to the shelter. It's an critical resource for the community. Again, we shelter about 400 folks a year.
Men and women?
It's an all-gender shelter. And because we built it with that intention. So it's a wonderful resource for the community. But just to put some context around that, we also have to turn away almost 1,400 requests for shelter a year. So the need is critical in the community. And if you can imagine sort of having to leave your home because you're in danger coming into shelter, it's so important that that space is warm and welcoming and healing. And it's, again, if you think of having 4,000 house guests in the past 10 years, it's hard to keep up with the space. So we're the campaign that we're rolling out is really one where all of us can be part of creating a safe and healing space for survivors, whether that's $25 that goes towards the purchase of paint to, you know, $1,500 that goes towards the renovation of an entire room.
And how long typically does somebody spend at the shelter?
Generally, people can stay for up to 6 weeks. We have expanded our post-shelter housing program. So what we're trying to do is get people stabilized, safe, stabilized, and out of the crisis environment and in either back to their safe home or into another home as quickly as possible. But it's, you know, this is a community where affordable housing is a nightmare for everyone. And you can imagine the additional challenge for a survivor trying to rebuild after violence.
How pervasive is this issue of domestic violence? I mean, you talked about the amount of calls that you're getting and the amount of requests you're getting for people who need a safe place to be away from their home. I'm sure that's just the tip of the iceberg, that there are many people who would never even think to leave their home, even though they're dealing with some type of violence
right
every day.
Well, and most people experiencing violence don't leave their home. We see about 2,000 adults and kids each year. And again, about 400 of those are through the shelter. And other people can reach out. They can Our legal advocacy program is a great resource for people who may need a protection order or some way to remove an abuser from the home or from their lives. Sometimes just the counseling services that can be so critical in helping a survivor just identify what their needs are, what their resources are, how to deal with the trauma and the crisis of violence, but also move forward. And I think that's that oftentimes people continue to think of sort of, you know, domestic violence programs as being primarily just shelters. And we really are encouraging the community to look beyond that. Again, shelter's like an emergency room. You always need one. But there's so much more that we can do around prevention and intervention.
Talk about some of those prevention programs, because this should start at birth, I would imagine, because we're yes. bombarded every day with images of violence. And so how do you counteract that and create a culture of nonviolence?
Which is such a great point. We have a pretty expansive prevention program, and now that school's back in session, we have three school-based violence prevention educators that are working in elementary and middle school doing evidence-based prevention programming. And in the high school, we have a Peers Building Justice program, which is a cohort of high school-age youth that come together and are addressing issues not just specific to dating violence or domestic violence, but really looking at, you know, the culture of inequity and oppression, and how whether it's racism or anti-immigrant sentiments or classism, how that inequity can lead to violence, and whether it's that violence takes root in an interpersonal relationship or is how someone is experiencing being alienated from their own community. It's something that we believe we can change.
Has the Me Too movement impacted this entire narrative around domestic violence? And bear in mind, it is a spectrum. So we're seeing right now play out the very extreme end of that, where the awful murders of a woman and her two children, a pregnant woman. But there is a spectrum, and you're dealing with people who are dealing with emotional abuse, financial abuse, as well as then physical and sexual assault as well. I mean, it is a spectrum. Has the Me Too movement impacted at least how we're talking about this?
I think it has in a positive way. And part of that is recognizing how power plays out in relationships. And even when a relationship may start from a positive place, may feel loving and equal, when someone chooses to use power and control in their relationship to minimize the other person's experience, to control them, to diminish who they are, that has long-term consequences. And there is sort of a grooming that happens in those relationships. And I think the Me Too movement has been and has provided stories that help us kind of frame that. Often survivors, whether survivors of intimate partner violence or workplace assaults, survivors are groomed to kind of ignore their own fear or to blame themselves for whatever assault or abuse that they experience. And the more that we can hear stories and see ourselves reflected in those stories, I think it has a powerful opportunity for prevention.
And I know that you are working in schools, you did say, with your anti-violence program. You know, is consent part of that conversation?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And that's such an important thing to start young with kids. And so, again, you kind of think about it, is that often adults, with good intention, you know, we grab kids and hug them and kiss them.
Or demand they kiss their aunt or uncle or grandparent.
So we give really mixed messages about consent. That's important, I think, for us really at early ages to talk to kids about their own, their boundaries, the importance of being able to say what they're comfortable with, and to respect each other's boundaries.
Do you have a sense of how pervasive domestic violence is right now?
In Boulder County, we can extrapolate just based on police reports. And unfortunately, we don't have really updated police reports, but there are typically about 1,800 calls to law enforcement related to domestic violence each year. And if you take the FBI estimates that 1 in 10 cases is ever reported to domestic violence. That's about 18,000 cases of domestic violence that are happening in our community. And again, if you sort of pull that out further, that's almost 50 a day. So if you think about that, that there are 50 incidents of domestic violence that could require law enforcement involvement, that's an epidemic. And it's really the silence behind that that SPAN as an organization is interested in breaking. We have wonderful examples of other public health crises. The opiate crisis right now, I think, is a good example where an issue has remained secret and grows and escalates because people aren't willing to talk about it or don't know how to talk about it. And we, you know, all of these years later, again, SPAN's almost in its 40th year, all these years later, we're still fighting that same battle of really encouraging the community to talk openly about relationships, about safety, and to talk not just to people that were concerned who are being victimized, but to talk to people who are using violence in control, really focus on sort of the offenders or the people that are creating the danger, and encourage a cultural shift that holds those folks accountable and creates other ways for relationships to be healthy.
And are our laws adequate in terms of protecting victims? Because I remember a few years ago hearing that when law enforcement would be called to a domestic violence situation, often they would arrest both parties as they try to figure out who is the guilty party. So very often you might have somebody who's been the victim of violence ending up being arrested. I know that's changed.
It has some, and that's an entirely new conversation that we could have, and we probably should have. You know, again, the estimate is that less than 30% of victims ever contact law enforcement. So I think really looking at other ways to be a resource to survivors is really critical. And the reality for certainly for undocumented immigrants, for people that may identify as LGBTQ or queer, for people of color who feel targeted by law enforcement, for lots of folks, calling the police doesn't feel like a safe option. So I think as a community, we want law enforcement, we want the laws to do the right thing and to be a resource around the crime of domestic violence. But that can't be the only thing that we're looking at.
And as you said there are many people who are fearful of engaging with law enforcement for a variety of reasons. And I'd also heard that, and maybe you can give me the details, that mandatory reporting requirements around domestic violence. So if somebody was to show up in an emergency room, is it required if it's suspected that it's domestic violence that somebody might call the police?
Actually, the law changed last year. There had been and this has been the case for a number of years, that medical professionals were required to report domestic violence in the same way that they're required to report any sort of criminal injury related to a crime. But a year ago, the law was modified. What medical professionals are required to do now is to connect the person to a community service. The victim may want the law enforcement called, and certainly, our local medical professionals are great about that. But if the victim doesn't want law enforcement, the medical professional needs to ensure that the victim's connected to a community-based resource like SPAN or other advocacy programs that can ensure that the victim's concerns around safety, where they go after they leave the emergency room, for example, that those are addressed.
That would seem like progress.
I think so.
For people who are listening now, once again, that number, which is known as the crisis hotline, but it's really an information line. So even if you are concerned about somebody in your universe, or if you yourself are concerned about your own safety, this is a number you can get information. You don't need to be in a crisis situation. It's 303-444-2424, 303-444-2424. We'll also put a link to the website because it has a lot more resources, as well as information on how people can help as you're renovating the shelter. But in the last couple of minutes, Anne, what would you like people to know as we're talking about domestic violence today, but now we're seeing this play out, and it will play out for several weeks, this horrific story that I know will trigger many people, but will also maybe trigger conversations about domestic violence?
And that's exactly it, is use this as an opportunity for conversation. So my hope is that As people are watching the news, or you know, watching the news with their kids, and their kids are seeing these horrific cases, really use it as a chance to talk about the importance of being safe in relationships, and that there are places to go, there are people that you can talk to. We need to get over our hesitance to talk about violence when it's happening in a family. And the reality is that, you know, it's about 1 in 3 women and about 1 in 7 men experience intimate partner violence in their lifetime. So there are a lot of folks in our lives today that are experiencing some form of controlling or abusive behavior. And the more that we're able to talk to each other and be a resource to each other and get over our own sort of fear or hesitation, I think the better we are going to be as a community.
Well, we will put a link to the website, safehousealliance.org, and that number again, 303-444-2424. In the meantime, thank you so much, Anne Tapp, Executive Director of SPAN. That's the Safe House Progressive Alliance for Nonviolence. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Maeve. I appreciate it.